Right. Yeah, and we're live. We are live and recording. So this is Brain Food Live, episode 18. Episode 18 of Brain Food Live on air. This I'm delighted to be doing this. We've had a 2-week break, I think, for no good reason other than the fact that I wasn't in town. But I'm pleased that we're rolling this one back out. And I'm joined as ever by Brain Food Chief Promoter Adam Gordon. Adam, how are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Delighted to be here as always, and looking forward to talking more about artificial intelligence.
I know. I mean, we had a great show last week, sort of last time we ran this, and it ended up being sort of one of those topics that could have continued for a lot further. So I wanted to explore this, and in particular, because we've got like a couple of great AI events coming up, in particular, CogX happening in June later this year, which I hope I have time to attend, actually, because it will be a the last time I was there, it was a fantastic event. So I hope that I'll be there. Meg Butler will join us for this chat, as will a bunch of other smart folks that are going to guide us through AI. But before we dive into all of that, let's have a review of what happened last week, Adam. Brain Food went out as usual at 137 on Sunday. What did you find particularly interesting that week, mate? It's okay if you can't remember. I mean,
go ahead. I'm sorry. I've got to be honest. For the first time ever, I'm struggling desperately to find Brain Food from last week so that I can remind myself what the things were that I liked. But I posted a bunch of things on Facebook that I liked.
I know. I tell you what was popular though. The 20 recruitment metrics is really popular. Which was a bit of a surprise to me, because I thought that, hey, it was really good, but I would have thought that it wasn't really teaching anybody anything new. This was the post by Hired by Google, and they were just doing things, talking about how you would measure recruitment forms and so on. But that got like something like 1,000 views or something, which 1,000 clicks, should I say, which on Brain Food is very high. And that ultimately was super, super popular.
Well, yeah, I'm not surprised. I'm remembering everything now. A year of emails from recruitment agencies was comedy gold.
Yes.
And it was, and I mean, the good, the bad, and the ugly in there. And email remains the number one channel in recruitment for communicating with candidates, for communicating with hiring managers and or HR if you're an agency, and it's just so badly used still today in 2019.
Yeah, so for the people who don't realize, this is from a Brain Food reader actually called Richard Saunders. He's an internal recruiter, he basically kept all of the inbound from agencies that came at him, and he just did some analysis on it as to when people were sending, what months, how many times people continued to send even if he didn't say anything. It was quite educational. He finished off with a bit of kind of recommendations as to what you should do if you were approaching him in future in his guise as an in-house recruiter. It's the predominant way in which we still hustle business. You know, we ping cold emails out. So, difficult to criticize. I've done that. You've done that. We probably still do that. Its efficacy is going down, I think, over time. And we're probably reaching to the point where we've got to come up with new ideas as to how to connect with customers, really.
We are, we're competing as humans. We are competing with so many other non-traditional competitors to get our messages to the people that we're trying to communicate with. And we have to just continue to be more and more creative about the ways that we do that. Email works. I'm absolutely confident that email still works today in 2019. And in fact, across every customer, every industry, talking to every group of kind of potential candidates, I can see that it's the number one performing channel. However, you've got to be really smart. And so most people, because it's easy to use, most people are bad at it.
Yeah, that's probably exactly it. It's so accessible. Like, everyone has got an email. Everyone can send an email. That, of course, that means that lots of crap email is out there. And how you differentiate that, I think there's a number of techniques to do it. But it's a deeper science. It's probably a topic we should talk about, actually. What is the best practice on email? Because we can't really get away from it, at least not for now. I think as the new generation of folks start entering the workforce, and I want to talk about generational stereotyping in a future topic as well, because I think we need to rehabilitate these stereotypes, because I do believe there's going to be a big shift completely away from email, because it's very keyboard centric, very screen dependent. The generation entering the workforce now, you know, these are the mobile first guys. They're not really looking at email at all. They're looking at chat much more than email. So I think business development, candidate acquisition and stuff like that, so that audience has to be completely different.
So I agree with you. I think that that's maybe a different show. And I think it's well worth doing that, because you're right. Well, things are going to change. In fact, you and I were talking about the common verbal kind of, written communication that we're using is changing. And we're not necessarily writing words the same that we were. We're using emojis and things. So there's a lot of things changing. However, I do believe that today email remains dominant. And Felix has asked for some tips and what makes a good email campaign. And I've got loads to add on that, but that is definitely a separate show. And one of the other reasons why I think we shouldn't do that is because I want to talk about the ways that you make money today. And the ways that you make money today are more broad than they ever have been, or they're more varied than they ever have been. And as per BrainFood, GitHub has come up with yet another way for people to get paid for their work. And that's another great flexible innovation in the way that we can go and earn a living.
Not many people clicked on this, but I really wanted them to do that, because GitHub, of course, is a collaboration software. Everyone, 36 million developers on it, something like 100 million projects. I think most tech recruiters know to use GitHub to try and identify talent. But they rolled out something, and I've just shared it on the chat box there, in which people can actually start rewarding with cash great contributors on GitHub. And this is an example of internet points basically translating into hard cash, because you can imagine someone who is a GitHub, you know, hero. He's got heavily followed, heavily starred. He's a big contributor online. Suddenly he can monetize that. And that is a crowdsource way of generating revenue, where there's no relationship between them. There's no employer there. You know, the community is basically volunteering micropayments to this person, and it could be a very lucrative way of doing it. So I think a very interesting move by GitHub to move into the gig economy, essentially.
The Economist's jobs boom and the growth of women in the kind of, you know, overall economy. Was something that I thought was really interesting. And you linked that, interestingly, in BrainFood to the rise of populism, and these things are kind of at odds with each other.
I might have done that. I don't know why I did. I'm sure it was a very intelligent reason to do that at the time. But yeah, I mean, The Economist
jobs
basically...
growth.
Yeah, The Economist basically made quite a robust defense of capitalism, basically, and saying, hey, listen, life is not that bad. Actually, we're seeing all of these things pointing in this direction. They did link very tellingly to the presence of women in the paid workforce as a reason for a lot of these things happening, which they presented as positive. But I think that even though they may be factual, though they may be the facts, what we're seeing with a lot of populism is actually people are taking those facts and taking an opposite view. I've got kind of to study the far right. I got into it a little bit this weekend. And a lot of it, you know, I was wondering why far right seems to be anti-feminist, right? I mean, I couldn't quite work out why that was. I could get it if they were anti-immigrants, you know, I could get it if they were kind of, pro-white, anti-non-white, but why were they anti-feminist? You know, it didn't seem to make sense. But a lot of it seems to be about, because, you know, when women enter the workforce, they basically stop having kids or not having as many kids. And that's like a massive problem, because we're getting swamped by these immigrants, etc. So, you know, it kind of gets dark really quickly when you start examining some of the dialogue and some of the theories that power this rise of the right wing. So yeah, dude, that's going to be another topic, probably a long running stream.
Yeah.
We don't want to get into it right now, because today, the reason why people are tuning in, they want to hear about AI in recruitment. And I'm going to immediately bring on two folks that I want to talk to straight away. Megan Butler, who is working at Cogex, and she's got a really interesting background because she works in HR side, but now also as a research person, doing a PhD in AI and working, of course, with this great events and community business, Cogex. And also I want to bring in Vineet from Pocket Recruiter, who we brought on right at the end. And he came out, I think, with the most intelligent commentary, and we want to give him like 5 minutes. So I'm going to bring those two straight away. And let's turn this into a four-way chat and see where we're at. So let's see if I can find these folks.
So while you're bringing them on, I think it links really nicely from one other of the articles that was on Brain Food on Sunday, which was Harvard's study around people prefer algorithmic, judgment over human judgment.
Yep.
And I know that's an article that Tengai was reading and liked this week.
Yep.
And so I think it's probably right. I think that humans are going to trust an algorithm more than they are a human.
That's probably going to be the first topic. So let me just firstly welcome these two wonderful people here. Vineet, great to see you, man. I know it's like super early for you over in California. So I do thank you for spending that early morning time with us. And Megan, great to see you again. And welcome to the show.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Great stuff. So Adam actually just raised an interesting point, which I'm going to dive straight into, because this was an article published by Harvard Business Review, and they did a study actually on algorithmic decision making. And apparently they came up with some counterintuitive results in the sense that from their study, it seemed that human beings often preferred or trusted the algorithm over a human decision, and that caused a bit of a stir, because you know the prevailing wisdom seems to be the opposite of that. Is that surprising to you guys? Would you say? I mean, Vineet, if I can come to you,
it's not really surprising, but it's indicative of sort of a trend of mistrust, and the algorithm is seen as sort of this arbiter of truth. It has all this data, it has all this information, it has all this computing power, therefore it must be, you know, this sort of neutral arbitrator. And like I said, there's a lack of trust almost of people. When you look at people, so many, especially in the recruiting world, have been sort of burned by one bias or another. So many people they felt like they've been excluded rather than included into a candidate pool. And so a lot of screening is kind of at fault for that. They feel like with an algorithm, they're going to get a fair shot. They're going to be more included. They're going to be more reviewed because the algorithm has that sort of capability. Whereas a human is just going to read, you know, they say, what is it, to spend an average of 15 seconds on a resume or something like that. And so they don't trust that they're going to get a fair shake.
Yeah. And isn't it true that human beings do make, I mean, psychologists might want to confirm this, but human beings do make decisions, or the most important part of the decision making actually happens at the micro moments at the very beginning of the interaction. So this person, I might be making that judgment even subconsciously and thinking, you know what, I don't like that guy. And then no matter what you say, that's difficult for you to turn that around. Whereas perhaps we can trust artificial intelligence not to at least make that type of mistake.
And that's a misunderstanding. If you're learning from the decisions of people who are biased, inevitably your algorithm is also going to be biased. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done in order to pick the right data sets that are going to lead to a decision that, I mean, all data sets are biased, but you want to pick a data set that's biased towards a candidate rather than a data set that's biased towards excluding candidates. And that's a very important piece of the AI puzzle when it comes to, the HR tech space or the recruiting space.
Okay, let me just explore that a little bit more with you, Vineet. you've just said that all data is biased. Can you just unpack mm-hmm. that for us a little bit? Because, you know, how is that true? And why are you so confident in saying that that's the case?
Well, when you look at the way that data is gathered, inevitably it's back to a person. There's no data that a human hasn't touched in one way, shape, or form, whether that's through the creation process, the gathering process, the analysis process. It's touched by people, and people bring to the table their biases. If it's decision, you know, it's decision-based data, which a lot of recruiting data is. If you've got a resume, the resume is biased towards the candidate. If you've got a job description, the job description is biased towards the company's understanding of what they need and what they want. Sometimes it's an accurate bias. Sometimes it's really, I mean, if you're a recruiter, you've read job descriptions where you say that's not even close. That's a really bad job description. And so no matter what data set that you're looking at, whether it's hiring decisions, who actually got hired, who actually got selected, you're looking at data that's been touched by a person. And each one of those people, you know, either as an individual or as a crowd, we bring our biases to those data sets.
So what's the response to that, Vineet? Like, what do we do if we accept that that's the premise? All data is biased. I mean, how do you de-bias that? And what is the best practice that we could, you know, as non-professional, as non-sort of data science people, what do we need to look out for? How can we support a fairer way, I guess, of assessing these folks or using AI when we're assessing these folks?
When you talk about de-biasing, there's two, you know, sides of the machine learning puzzle in HR tech and in recruiting. You've got the what I call the Captain Obvious side. And, you know, those are the types of machine learning which produce results where a person goes, well, yeah, okay, yeah, no, I kind of already knew that, or it's fairly obvious, you know, to anyone looking at that sort of result. That's the type of data set that you can de-bias, because with that type of machine learning, the insights that you're getting are fairly obvious. And so you can look at your data set and say, well, there's going to be some obvious biases introduced, so I'm going to take those out. I'm going to anonymize a resume from the perspective of protected classes and so on. I'm going to take the bias that I know would get into the algorithm out. The second type of machine learning is where actual insights are coming in. That's where a lot of technology now in the HR tech space, recruiting space, is shifting to, where the insights that are gathered are no longer obvious. They're insights that a person or a recruiter would look at and go, huh. Yeah, it makes sense, but wouldn't really thought of it that way. And that's where we start talking about introducing candidates that you wouldn't have discovered in the first place. Introducing candidates that may have the skill set that's necessary, but they may actually be in a totally different field, or they may be in a job where they're ready to progress forward, or, you know, and those are just a couple of vague examples, but you kind of get where I'm going, where you as a recruiter are now getting valuable insights from the system. That's where debiasing is a myth, because if what insights are coming out of the system are no longer obvious, the biases that the system is learning are no longer obvious. And so you really have to get to the end result and then reverse engineer it to try to figure out where the biases come from. This is where companies like Amazon and Facebook have failed when it comes to building recruiting tools, is that when you start getting into this world of you know, outside of the Captain Obvious space, starting to give real insights into your data and starting to find patterns that are not completely obvious to a person, you begin to all of a sudden introduce biases that are sourced from the data in ways that aren't obvious to you. And so instead of doing this sort of act of debiasing and hoping for the best, and then kind of coming out the other end, and after a lot of analysis saying, ah, this didn't work out the way I wanted it to, there is bias in this. Mm. It's better to start with a data set that's biased towards a candidate rather than starting with a data set that could have a different decision bias, because nobody's going to ever be upset about somebody saying, well, yeah, you know, the candidate made themselves look good. And I don't like that. I don't want a candidate to make himself look good or sound good. That's not a bias anyone's going to be upset about, because it's a bias towards the candidate. It's a bias towards inclusion.
Yeah, I think another way to think about this is that the role that AI plays is really about, the role is not about affirmative decision making. It's never going to hire anybody for you. What it will do is screen folks out, And you've just got to, as you say, Vineet, you've got to make sure that if it's doing that screening and before it hits the human being, the humans around it have got to figure out, look, we need to make sure that we're not screening out the wrong folks based on characteristics that are not relevant to the job. And I guess that's where there needs to be interaction, like a heavier human element to this, rather than sort of leaving the machine to go ahead and take on that chunk of that chunk of the funnel.
And you also want your machine learning to understand that a resume and a job description are incomplete documents. And so in many cases, you are having to fill in some of the blanks for the job description. You're going to have to fill in some of the blanks for the candidate. And so just what's there in both documents isn't enough. And that's also a type of bias where you get candidates who haven't presented themselves fully for a particular job. You get job descriptions that haven't presented themselves fully or have over-presented themselves for the actual role that they're hiring for. And you almost have to be, you know, in a lot of ways we want the human involved, but you have to reveal things to that human that allows them to make a better decision than they normally would on their own. And that's really, you know, that's when you go beyond automation and you go towards something that adds value to a recruiter rather than something that simply takes away a couple of pieces of their work.
Lots to ponder, Vineet. Lots to ponder. You know, when you're talking about a lot of this, I'm just thinking, wow, recruiters as an industry, as a discipline, are generally under-equipped to deal with all of this. You know, you get the feeling, I mean, I think a lot of the reasons why, you know, we've got a bunch of people watching this show is to try and educate themselves and try and get to the point where, you know, they've got the grasp of these issues. But we've just never had the training. We've never had even the sort of the development of the thinking tools to be able to grasp a lot of this. So I'm going to just throw it open to the audience. Maybe you can come in on this one as well, Meg. I mean, particularly someone with your background who's kind of got a foot in both camps to a certain degree. Where would you say that sort of the recruiters and HR folks who've encountered AI late, let's say, where should we go to try and upskill our knowledge? Where do we find this information out?
Thank you. I just have so much information that wants to spill out from that last discussion. It was fantastic, and I think there were really good points made. And I know exactly as you say, having a foot in both camps, I see this comment about reverse engineering, and it's a hugely important point. And we sometimes take it lightly in HR because we don't really understand what that means, and that really means that's our governance system and making sure that the algorithm is actually working the way it's supposed to. We can't just pull the human out of this process. It's helping us make better decisions. It's not making the decisions for us. We can, this is why critical thinking is going to become even more important as a skill in the future, because we have to be able to think critically about more information, because we'll just be provided with so much more insight. Anyways, I digress. I can digress forever on this topic.
No, Meg, I want to just pick that one point out for the audience a little bit. I think a lot of the reason why I see people are critical of AI as a broad topic is that they feel that it's a substitute for human decision making. Whereas in fact, if we kind of move away from that sort of rather archaic view of it and see it as more as decision support, then we can kind of, you know, make it less threatening. Which I think is big part of the reason that stops us from learning more about it. But anyway, I just wanted to highlight that point that you made, Meg. So continue on the thread that you're about to go on.
No, you're totally right. You nailed it. We did have, or there's been a lot of literature, even when I started my research, really specifically in this area over 2 years ago, or nearly 2 years ago, the narrative was very much that all-sum game, where it was either AI doing all of the work or humans. And the narrative has moved along. It's still not as strong as it needs to be, but it's about augmenting. So it's about making better decisions. It's about having better processes and experiences by automating, especially with smart intelligence or smart automation where we can, processes, but realizing when we need to kick it to a human and we need to have that human touch in there to deal with the more critical and more important and the more emotionally sensitive interactions. When you're having a customer service issue and it's serious, like you've had fraud on your bank account, you don't want to be dealing with a chatbot. you want to definitely have a human on the line that's empathizing with your situation. So, so that was a really great conversation. And that what my work is really trying to draw out is when we have this technical dialogue, what does that mean for the HR professional? And what does that mean for the department? And how should we be thinking about it in order to work with the technology? I'm sure you can see in the background my stats for dummies, because I've been trying to figure out machine learning from the very bottom to the top and realizing that's a stretch for anybody to understand. Anybody who understands that is quite impressive. But for HR, what we need to understand is how are we working with it? How are the decisions being made? As you rightly point out, that our information is very incomplete, but we do have a lot of information. How are we able to structure that and use it and utilize it? And then how do we link that back as we think about this concept of freeing up HR's time? Because now we're reducing our pre-screening process by so if we think about it in terms of number, a million resumes in a year is roughly about one FTE equivalency of a person checking resumes for 6 minutes, for 6 seconds, 8 hours a day, day in, day out, without a holiday. And now we can turn that into a process that in the first few minutes of the morning, it scanned all the CVs. It's actually probably already done automatically as it comes in. You're able to see your top ones that you should be looking at. You're able to also and should be looking through the ones that maybe it didn't recommend, because we need to think about, in terms of the governance, how do we improve the system going forward? So it's not just about trying to get rid of a job. It's about improving what the initial job is, so we can reduce the information down into something more structured and make a more structured process going forward. And then from there, think about how do we use that time we've saved now to improve the process? How do we feed back in performance data later to show that, yes, this was a good decision. No, maybe this isn't. There's something wrong with this decision. And that's how we really make the system smarter.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, even the volume itself has a quality, doesn't it? Because recruitment is like all jobs. It's there. Optimal stopping is basically what we do. You know, we're not searching for the best candidate on the planet. Of course we aren't. It's going to take us forever. We're gonna stop when we found a guy or found a candidate or a girl or whatever it is that we think that's a placeable candidate. I'm going to stop now and see whether this person's good enough. Now, I guess what AI might be able to help us do, particularly when you're talking about this huge sort of textual processing, is expand the amount of people we can actually process and therefore be fairer, I guess. Because there's got to be a sample bias when, you know, I'm going to stop at this 50 CVs. I'm going to go to the places that I know, but, you know, 50 CVs is not a lot. If I can expand that to a million and I'll have a much larger talent pool to reach those candidates from and not spend any more time doing that. So I think there's some, probably I would hope that we'd accept that as an application of AI that we should welcome, I think.
I think, you know, you've hit an interesting point, and that is in any application that's given to a person that has AI baked in and machine learning baked in, there's got to be a way for that person to just turn it off and say, look, I'm 100 times smarter at this than you are. And even though you could have helped and you kind of gave me some good suggestions, some great ideas, thank you. But now I'm going to turn you off and I'm going to show you exactly what I need to do. And there needs to be that capability in AI or AI enabled products for the user to just kind of hit the off switch and say, okay, get out of my way. I need to, you know, I've got what I need as far as tools are concerned. I've got this automation and the ability to go through a million resumes or 3 million resumes or whatever it is, but do it my way.
I mean, do you see that as being a vendor responsibility to build that in? Yes. Yes. You do. Yep. Oh, I mean, yeah. Actually, Vineet, I want to share with the crowd here those questions that mm-hmm. That you pose, that you would actually recommend vendors pose, sort of buyers of software pose to vendors. I thought that was a really interesting blog post. So I'm going to share right here. I wonder whether we could pick some of these out. Sure. Because they, I think, are really useful things to explore. And you kind of did this in, you had a session here at Unleash, I think, Vin, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I had a really good panel at Unleashed. And looking at this, I mean, that's one of the things I took away, was that when it comes to machine learning, and I'm going to get away from the AI buzzword, I'm going to use machine learning, which is kind of our industry term. When it comes to machine learning, and you know, the to what you were saying a little earlier, how do we know what questions to ask? You know, how do you know as recruiters what questions to ask if no one's giving you enough information for you to formulate these questions on your own? And there's a lot of in machine learning, you know, this is what machine learning is. Slide one, it's going to, you know, it's going to do all these amazing things. It's perfect. Slide two is blank. Slide three is results, profit, amazing things. And we don't fill in slide two very well. And so we don't give people enough information to ask the right questions. So what I tried to do in this blog post was, if I was buying, you know, if I was going out there and I was looking and evaluating systems, these are the questions that I would ask. And, you know, one of the most important questions is to ask, what's really machine learning and what's programmed? And you're calling it machine learning, but it's, that distinction's kind of questionable. And that's really an important question to ask, because a lot of what's built into these systems is hard-coded, which means I'm telling the application, do this, do this, do this, do this. And a lot of times that gets lumped into machine learning because somebody used an analysis of data at some point to come up with that.
Okay, can I just
go ahead.
I was going to say, can I just, we've gone really quite technical quite quickly. Can we just chunk up for a second? Because we're talking about one specific aspect here. And this is really for you, Megan. What are the, when you think about machine learning and HR, but specifically in recruitment, AI within recruitment, what are the different aspects of recruitment that are today benefiting from artificial intelligence? Because we're talking a lot about matching, and there's a lot of other things that solutions that are getting provided as well. So what do you see, Megan?
That's a great question. I wish I had a better answer, but the biggest movement is in sourcing and selection. And it's really interesting. You kind of start diving into this topic, and I'm curiously watching the chat going away on the right-hand side. Mm-hmm. But what it's able to do is things that we're notoriously bad at. I know I've been a recruiter in the past. I've worked with lots of people who've done high volume recruiting. And I don't want to admit on public record the worst reason I ever threw a resume out for, but we've all done it. I do love the meme around, we're going to throw out the first 50 resume because we don't hire the unlucky. It's doing those high volume jobs that we're terrible at that can look at the first resume and the last resume against the same light, and not about what was the last resume before that, what you had at lunch, whether you're sleepy, whether you want to go home, whatever. There's so many things that we put on resumes because in our mind, a manager is a middle-aged white male with a beard and glasses. We put so many ridiculous biases, and it's able to just take the same thing and go over and over and over again. I know we have some other guests online that can go into deeper aspects around some of the how they're able to work with the algorithm. And I also like, it's also one of our big panels at CogX. This is a huge topic about how it works. And that's why we have Frida Polly, I'm gonna blank it out, Mary Claire Race, Dominic Holmes, an employment lawyer who's doing work into this area as well, hosted by Thomas, and I'm missing one really important person on that. Lauren Larson from HireVue, their CTO, to talk about this exact topic, because it's huge and there's so much attention around it. And it's kind of like really distorting it, because like when we talk about bias in an algorithm, we're talking about like one very small piece of technology in a broad umbrella of technologies available that are hitting every function of HR, from the day how we attract candidates all the way to how we deal with them after they've left the organization. There's not one part of the process that AI is not touching in some way. And if it isn't a ton of products touching it already, it's just because people are trying to crack the code or discover that that's a problem we can fix using artificial intelligence. So we're seeing it all over, but definitely the low hanging fruits where the products are kind of strong in is around the sourcing, because it's able to source passive candidates in a really tight recruitment market, really tight labor market. If we can source candidates faster, and have a short list of 100. And as was pointed out earlier, They may not have been what you're exactly looking for, but they fit other criteria. They were worked in a similar business, a similar in a different industry, but that went through a similar growth process or whatever you're looking for. And you can all of a sudden start matching people that, unless as a recruiter, you have the intelligence to know that, for example, somebody who works with data sets in healthcare, they could probably work with data sets in almost any other role, but you may not realize that. So it's helping to identify and helping with that selection. And then the next kind of like after insights, we're seeing a lot of movement around automation, and especially more intelligent automation coming out, which is really helpful, able to do things but much more controllable and able to help with really specific tasks. Some really cool case studies where HR professionals get their hands on a tool which is meant for one thing, and then do something completely different with it that as designers it was never thought of. And then kind of at the bottom coming in a really interesting way is chatbots, which I think the coolest part of that is, again, you know, it's been easy to replace conversations around FAQs, even form filling exercises. But what's really neat is kind of some new ideas on how to make business documents two-way and understanding how employees are interacting with, for example, your company policy manual.
Really interesting. I wonder if, are people buying, because there's a lot of conversation on the chat here about what really is AI, is what we've got here actually machine learning, and is machine learning AI? Some of the things that people have been talking about, I don't think they're either. Those, I think they're automation, which leads me on to the next question, which is, are buyers buying products and technology so that they can tell their friends and their colleagues that they're using artificial intelligence? Because quite frankly, that's not what they need. What they need is to get their work done, get more of their better work done faster is what they need. So does it matter if it's AI enabled or not?
Yeah, at the end of the day, no one cares if I exist. Really, anyone that's a user doesn't care that I'm here. You know, I can make the coolest AI in the world. I can make the coolest machine learning in the world. But the benchmark is, does it work? Does it work the way a user wants it to work? And so that interface between this machine learning that's sort of an amorphous concept that, you know, again, in the blog piece that I wrote, I tried to bring through some questions that can be answered. But at the end of the day, an HR professional can't be expected to be a machine learning expert. And so the proof is really in the pudding. It really is, how does this work? Does it work? Do your users love it? Or do they look at it and go, oh, God, I can't. I hate this thing. It's always in my way. It doesn't feel native. It's been built in this way that's all about the machine learning, and it doesn't have any idea how I actually do my job, and it's not helping me. It's getting in my way. And so, you know, it's important to understand the benefit at the end of the day, and it's important for us as machine learning companies to sort of focus on the user experience more than we focus on AI for AI's sake. And really, you know, that question of how much of your software is just programmed, how much of it is just open source, how much of it is just, here's a ton of data. I don't really know where I got it from. We got it from all over the place. We don't really have a pedigree on it. We don't really understand what biases are in it. You know, here's a ton of data. Here's small algorithm, you know, attacking data. And here's the results. And here's this accuracy that we as data scientists and machine learning, you know, engineers use to say our stuff is amazing and it works. But at the end of the day, none of that matters. The real questions are, from HR practitioner's standpoint, talk to me about bias. Talk to me about diversity. Talk to me about how many FTEs am I saving by using your product. Talk to me about what we can do with all that time saved. Talk to me about how well it actually presents candidates to me. Talk about how easy it is to work with. You know, does it work the way I want it to work, or does it work the way a data scientist wants it to work? And that's really all that matters.
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point, and actually segues onto the next a position I want to bring a next guest on to about sort of the questions again that you've got to ask when you're speaking or implementing AI or any kind of technology really, but in specifically with regards to AI, you know, who owns some of this stuff? What's the compliance challenge here? All that type of thought process. That HR practitioners really need to get into. So I want to try and keep you two on screen if that's possible. I'm not even sure whether it is possible on Crowdcast, but I'm going to try and do that. And I want to invite on John Sumsner because I can see him here. And I know he's been thinking and writing a lot about this particular topic. And I just want to see if I can bring John on to see whether he can add some flavor to our chat here. Oh, there's no more seats left. I have to kick somebody else off. Would you mind at this point? Actually, Vineet, can I kind of ask you to step out for one sec and I'll bring sort of John in your stead. Yeah. And if you want to hang around, I'll see if I can bring you back on. Sure. I do beg your pardon. Give me a sec, Vineet.
So listen, while we're waiting for John to join, I've got one other comment to make about all of this, which is, that the recruitment world and the HR world is dominated by right brain thinkers. Okay, so almost all of us joined recruitment because we were pretty gregarious and enjoyed talking to people and are reasonably creative and probably less so analytical and technical type of individuals. That's definitely one of the... one of the reasons why I think we've been a little bit later in recruitment than maybe other job disciplines to really embrace technology. And also because we're quite boring compared to marketing tech and fintech, where they've had a lot more venture capital money.
On that point, Adam, I think that's absolutely right. One of the priority needs that I see for HR and TA is actually to start expanding and diversifying the types of people we bring into our functions, because we're totally under-equipped to deal with it. We do need to bring more scientific-minded people on. We need more scientists generally in TA. We need marketing people in TA. We can't just keep hiring recruiters and then expect that we're going to deal with this future that's coming at us. Ran over. I want to just say hi and good morning to John Sums. John, how are you doing, sir?
Hey, thanks for having me on, and hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
No, I mean, John, thank you for spending your some time with us. And I know you've been one of the few people in HR that has really spent a lot of thought analyzing the impact and the consequences of artificial intelligence. I think, again, similar to Megan, you're coming at it from two different camps, this time from tech to HR. I think you started off as a programmer, didn't you, in the 70s or so?
I did. Yeah,
so interesting to see almost the reverse journey that you're making from Megan's point of view. But I just wanted to, you've been writing some amazing blog posts recently, last two series about ethics and AI. I just wanted to ask you the question, like, what stimulated you to put pen to paper in this particular issue?
Oh, you know, I've been following this for a long time. Unleash in the, I don't know, 2011 or 2012, had a London event, and I did a day's worth of big data back then. And this is really just one way of thinking about this is this is just the natural evolution of our pattern of getting smarter and smarter about metrics. You know, as processing gets cheaper and storage gets cheaper, it's possible to do all sorts of things that were against the rules for most of the history of software. And so we're now getting to play with a new set of things. And I've been watching that for 40 years. So I like being on the, edge, and this is the edge. I think the question of how we understand people and their relationships to organizations is the single most complex and most important AI challenge, and that's with full understanding that what's going on right now isn't really AI. It's fancy statistics, and you can sort of slice the definitions a thousand different ways. I could probably make a career out of telling people that this is an AI, but it doesn't matter. It's what everybody's calling it, and the need to be right about what it is obscures the need to be effective in using the output of these things. So I don't think it matters what you call it. What you want to know is, how do you deal with it when you have it, and what are the things you should be concerned about? And so the first layer of that is, these are new employees. And the very first thing that you know about having a new employee is you're a moron if you trust them. Trust is earned over time. And it's really tricky because machines, when you get an output out of a machine, it looks like the truth. And for the entire history of software, the output of the machine was just a reformatting of the data that you gave it so you could be comfortable that it was the truth. Now, it's the data that you give it plus some data that you don't know what it is, plus some algorithm that you don't know what it is, and the machine gives you an opinion. And so the first thing that you need to do is go, is that opinion right? And that's really hard because the machine has all the data.
What are you saying there, John? Are you saying that the problem we've got is that we will lose our ability to make assessments, or we lose the confidence to make judgments because we have this machine, and machine's going to tell us, hey, I've processed a million records. This is what I think is true. Is your concern that we will lose the confidence to be able to refute that?
I'd say it differently. I'd say that it is very easy to believe what a machine says. It is very, very easy to believe machine output. And the truth about where we are is that this is a very, very primitive, early moment in the evolution of this stuff. And you better not believe what the machine says. You better not, or you're making a mistake. And there's a human unconscious tendency to trust authority figures, and machine output feels like an authority has just rendered a conclusion. And you're better if you treat it like it's the output of a brand new employee with no experience. That's all. That's all. We're not going to lose anything. I dispute the notion that there's something to be lost here. There's all sorts of stuff to be gained, but it comes with a lot of goddamned hard work. You know, it's not the idea that these machines start off by making your life easier is nonsense. They start off by making your life harder.
What would you say? In the general sort of trend of where AI is going as far as being implemented into recruitment, where would you say that we can see some obvious benefit, if there is any? I mean, is your position generally skeptical of it in its entirety, or can you see there's some areas where, there's evidence here?
There's a lot of really cool stuff, but it requires the thing that having a new coworker who's a machine does to you is it requires that you pay attention to stuff that you don't like to pay attention to. So the interview scheduling tools that organize entire teams and build structured interview maps so that you actually collect the right information when you're talking to a candidate, those things are awesome. Those things are awesome, but they run into a problem of overloading particular experts in the organization, and they run into a problem of if you don't keep your logs of who the relevant people are updated, they schedule people who don't work for the company anymore to do interviews because the machine only knows what you tell it. The machine has, but that Microsoft is saving tens of billions of dollars on interview coordination costs with interview scheduling things. So yeah, there's very cool stuff. Artificial intelligence, it's not, but delicious decision tree automation that takes routine processes and makes them more effective it is. Right. So there's that. The assessment stuff, there must be 70 vendors of new assessment products, and they're all trying to reduce the amount of time it takes to do an assessment and reduce the cost. So the idea is that you assess everybody that you interact with. And the ultimate goal is that by being on your job ad website, however that manifests, the behavior that you demonstrate on the job ad website is enough to give an assessment. And so that's where this is heading. Now we don't really know, except in general ways about very gross questions, whether or not a personality type is directly correlated to success in a particular job, right? That's the question that we don't have a good answer to. And we're going to find out by trusting machines to make those sorts of recommendations. But there's another thing that's going on. We're actually reaching the end of 20th century ways of visualizing data. So if you look at the resume sorting and sifting stuff, it always produces a ranked list. The idea that the best person for the job is the person who's on the top of that list only exists because that's how we had to do it when we didn't have this processing resource. The way that fit works in a job is a normal distribution curve. And the people that you want in a job are in the sweet spot in the distribution curve or the middle of the list rather than two standard deviations out at the top of the list. And we don't have a good way for consuming that information or expressing that information yet. Machines still tend to deliver information in a sequence, so you always think that the top of the list is the top of the list. But it's pretty clear that the best choice for a lot of jobs is in the middle of the list. And we don't know how to see that. We don't know how to talk about that yet. That's how we're going to evolve this total conversation about recruiting, is that we're going to have way better answers than this nonsense about winning the war for talent by always selecting the best people for the job. That's just such ridiculous crap that it makes me giggle.
I think, you know what? You've raised some very interesting points about the assessment aspect of AI and these types of technologies. And I notice, actually, we've got Dr. Nathan Mondragon on the chat there, and I'm quite keen to bring him on the show. He's the chief psychologist or something at Higherview, I believe.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy.
Yeah, I'd love to see if Nathan can join us, actually. Megan, would you mind if I kind of sat you down for momentarily on this? I beg your pardon.
Well, Megan, we gotta get all white guys on here at some point.
I'm the HR tech. Go ahead. Yeah. That's all good. I can't wait to hear the discussion.
Yeah, the reason for this, I actually thought I could bring on eight people onto this thing, but no, I can't. I have to only, the limit is four. So Meg, please stay with us. I'll try and bring you back after we have a chat with Nathan. But I'll try and bring him on now because I know he's in the States as well, and see whether he can give us some insight as well. Thanks a lot, Meg, for a sec.
John, just on your point about, you know, I mean, the notion of winning the war for talent using artificial intelligence and that being kind of ridiculous. If you can eliminate a vast amount of the tasks that recruiters were doing 15 years ago because they had to, then your recruiters have got a lot more time to focus on qualitative things that help you win the war for talent. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, I think maybe what happens is that, you know, recruiting has a dismal track record. The failure rate is often reported at 50%. So there's no place else in any organization where a 50% failure rate is tolerated.
No.
And so you would expect that what recruiters would do with additional time is to try to do their goddamn jobs. You know, and get the hiring decision right. And this is hyper controversial in the ranks of recruiters because it involves taking responsibility for things that are beyond your control, like everybody else in the company has to do.
No, hang on, John. On that one point, there's a in defense of the recruiters here, there is a political dimension to this because ultimately the recruiters rarely have the executive authority to make a hiring decision. That is also there's such a thing as a hiring manager in most organizations, and until we decouple that, until we actually have a talent acquisition function that's able to make an owner a hiring decision, I don't think you can throw it in all onto the recruiters here.
You know, there's a fundamental communications principle, which is in order to get 100% responsibility taken for a topic, I have to take 100% responsibility and you have to take 100% responsibility. And then you divide it by two, right? And so, yeah, recruiters are 100% responsible, and so are hiring managers 100% responsible. And the idea that there's some excuse available because you can't control everything, that's why people in companies get paid to manage stuff, because control is challenging and you don't get paid to only manage the things that you control. That's a dead-end career.
We could segue this conversation, John, and I'm going to do it because I'm just thinking sports here. You know how you where you might have a coach on the field coaching the talent, but you actually right. have a director of the acquisition side, head of scouting or whatever. Totally different type of function, but that one brings in the talent, the other manages and gets performance. I think maybe that's the future, and I can see some of the chat on the sideline maybe supporting that point. But that's another issue because we've got Mr. and Dr. Nathan Mondragon waiting patiently over there. Thank you so much for joining us, Doctor. I think I might have got your title wrong. I wasn't sure whether you're the chief psychologist or the chief product guy or the CTO at Hiveview. Can you just tell the audience what you do over there, Nathan?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the chief industrial psychologist. That's correct. Our CTO will be on the panel at COGX. I think it's next week, right, or the week after. I'm responsible for our AI-based assessment solutions that are rolled out using video interviewing and games to help companies hire the right people.
Yeah, and I think Hiveview have really pushed it hard. I mean, it started off as like async video product, right? You know, let's just make sure we improve it recruiting on the logistics side, but now it's very much an AI-driven product, isn't it, Nathan?
Yeah, that's correct. So we have 10 million videos in our database. So the idea is, can we use that data with our AI to create algorithms that do identify personality, cognitive traits, thinking styles, et cetera, and measure those through the AI with the video and the gameplay behavior that then, to John's point, statistically link to and predict who's going to be a good performer and who's not going to be a good performer once they get hired in the job. And so we've got a lot of research in the background documenting those types of results. So it's using the data, and it's really a combination. A lot of the conversation earlier was around data scientists driving these algorithm builds and baking bias from the data right into the algorithm, which is absolutely correct. One of the things we learned early on is you have to combine the fields of data scientists with the field of industrial psychology. So we have a team of 15 industrial psychologists at Hiveview and an equal sized team of data scientists that work together to make sure these algorithms are unbiased or unbiased as possible.
Dumb that down for me, Nathan. I might have to ask you to dumb it down several times. What is industrial psychology? Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, and on your side of the pond, it's called occupational psychology. We specialize in human behavior at work, and our teams at Hiveview specialize in building, testing, assessments, interviews, whatever sort of things you can use to measure individuals to determine who would be good at a job or not good at a job, who's good for promotion, who's not ready for promotion, those sorts of activities.
And the fundamental premise of Hiveview is that you're saying that you could assess an individual via video tech, capture that information, how they respond, their micro expressions, all of that type of stuff, and then you can predict their fit to a particular job and their job and their potential to perform in that particular job. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So we're all that is absolutely spot on. And the way we get there with the AI is we're, if you think about it, and this is, you know, we're not the only ones doing this. But the idea is if you're, you know, if you're interviewing me for a job, you're paying attention to what I say and how I say it, how I interact with you and how I engage with you. And you're processing all that in your head. And then you boil that information down into a couple of ratings on a competency form in a yes, no decision, something like that. We're able now with the machine and deep learning applications to binary code and database all of that information that you're processing. We now binary code it with our applications. And then research of that data of all the things that they say and how they say it, how they interact with you, all that data identify which elements or data points are predictive of success in some job, essentially.
Can you give us, and I know this is going to be an example you might be reluctant to give, Nathan, so I'll put a huge amount of caveats on all of this, I'm kind of forcing you in it, but can you ground it to us into an example? So for instance, what have you spotted as a pattern of how someone responds to question A that tells you that they would not be good in job X?
Let me actually change it a little bit. So let me give you an example of one of the patterns that we've identified that actually predict bias, right? That's a part of the discussion earlier. So there are certain things in the data that we've identified that typically have a tag to gender. So when we look at rate of speech, how fast people speak and how many white spaces or pauses, ums and ahs they have in their speech patterns, we've identified that females speak quicker and have fewer ums and ahs and pauses, right? Than males. I think it's always because they're smarter than we are. Right. So that's why they talk faster and have less, they have to think about things less, but that's a pattern that we've identified in the data, knowing that has a gender prediction to it. We now remove that data from the algorithm and make sure it's never scored or never weighted in the algorithm. You follow the same line of thinking of words and speech patterns and expressions that link to who's a successful customer service rep and who's not a successful customer service rep in a call center, for example. Same idea. You can start to identify those patterns in the data, and that's what we're looking for.
All right. So uncomfortable truth in this case then, and I'm just spooling thoughts, stream of consciousness here, but what if the data set that you have starts pointing to a certain direction and you're kind of forced to make an uncomfortable conclusion with that information you've received? Where do you see the vendor responsibility there? Is it the vendor's responsibility to make a difference, or do you think, hey, this is up to the ultimate employer? As an example, you might say, okay, we're doing a test and suddenly it looks like people from my part of the world, I group in the northeast of England, let's say, you know what, they're going to not perform well in this particular task because of whatever reason. And you might then think, you know what, that there's all kinds of problems with this. We can't have this, you know, we're potentially having a demographic we're not getting represented in the workforce. Is it the vendor's responsibility to do something about that? Or do you just present the data or to the employer and have them make that call?
No, I absolutely think it's the responsibility of the vendor or the AI provider to do those checks and do something about it or help do something about it. Right. In the U.S., there are certain guidelines or certain practices and principles that have to be followed from a legal perspective to make sure you're doing those checks. Right. It's called adverse impact checking. So if you're not providing advice to the customer on the algorithm that has been designed, has identified a bias, how do we help rectify or mitigate that? You're not doing right by your customer, by the buyer. So that's what we follow, right? I've got examples. I can't go into details on this, of course, but I've got examples where there's been a difference that's been identified. It could be a country difference, could be a regional, could be a racial gender. And that difference has existed, and it's actually rooted in the customer's data that then the algorithm takes and bakes into itself. So we identify that bias first before we build the algorithm. then start to look for how to rectify it or how to mitigate it, which is easy, you know, not easy to do, but it's doable to mitigate it out of your algorithms. And if you're not doing that as a provider, you're not doing right by your customers.
That's very interesting. How reliable is this? I mean, we're now moved on to this topic about vendor kind of responsibility. And I'm sure most vendors would be 100% aligned with the values that you put forward there, Nathan. But how reliable is that? All of this is self-certified, isn't it? Self-regulated. Vendors could choose not to do this.
Well, right. It is somewhat self monitoring, right? Self-directed, but in certain countries and in certain regions, there are rules and laws that suggest you that require you to do this. So that's sort of saying the uniform guidelines in the US require you to do what's called adverse impact testing. If you're going to implement or roll out an assessment or a selection tool, select in that, whether it's interviewing, sourcing and screening, an assessment, a test, whatever, you should be doing these adverse impact checks, which is a bias check. And if you're not doing that, you're not doing right by the customer, and the customer should be asking for it as well, right? And so it's not necessarily self-directed as much as there are some rules and laws and procedures and guidelines that require it in many cases. For government contractors in the U.S., it's an absolute requirement. It's not a question of should you; it's a question of you must.
So I wonder what you think about who holds the liability for the product. Does HireVue take liability responsibility, or does that become the responsibility of the customer?
Fair question. The liability is always with the customer, because we can't control the decisions that are made. You know, the analogy, and it's always a bad analogy, but the analogy is that the person that sells the gun doesn't control the shooter, right? Same thing. We can't control the decisions a hiring manager makes. What we can help control is the people that get presented to the hiring manager in trying to ensure that most of them are highly qualified given the algorithms that we build, but we can't control the decision that's made.
So given that you don't, offer some sort of quality assurance there on the output of your stuff, is the right way for somebody to buy your product to run it through an intensive legal review before they ever let it out in the system so that they clearly and totally own the liability?
And I wouldn't say we don't. You're making it, John, I think you're making it sound like we don't back it, right? That's not what I'm saying. We provide actually very detailed documentation that shows all the right steps were taken when this assessment was designed or this AI-based tool was designed and implemented, including the bias checks, the adverse impact checks, et cetera. That documentation and reporting is provided to our customers. I can't speak for other vendors. That is the ultimate defense. If there's a problem, they pull that off the bookshelf and show it. With that in mind.
So if I buy a defective car and you give me the engineering drawings for the defective car, it doesn't really help me, does it? Documentation is not backing. Documentation is a legal defense. And if you're not willing to accept liability for the product, my use of your documentation doesn't do me a whole boatload of good, does it?
Yeah, we actually have, I can't speak for everybody, right? But we actually have warranties.
Really? Oh, that's unusual and interesting.
Point something out quickly that John's name here on Crowdcast is Mr. Mild Irony.
So our warranties that we put in require certain procedures be followed so that they allow us to design and implement the assessment in a proper fashion and not cut corners, that kind of stuff. In those scenarios, we can provide warranties, et cetera. But again, it comes down to most adverse impact challenges or discriminatory challenges are based on who was actually hired. Right. If they want to look at auditing who passed a certain stage in the hiring process, we would absolutely back that because that's something that we can control because we do those adverse impact mitigation checks. So we know that if you're going to put in 10 applicants, five females, five males, there should be an equal representation of each that pass that stage. And we've got the documentation that's in the reporting, but we can't control of those 10 who gets hired. That's the difference.
That's it. I think it's not entirely clear what is or is not a defective product or service, because oftentimes the tool user, I mean, you could sell me a great car, but if I don't know how to drive it, I'm still going to crash it, right? So, you know, you could point out even a perfect, we're getting to the point where we can say that there's no such thing as a perfect car, because firstly, it wasn't designed for me. You know, I'm 5'7", you know, most cars are actually designed for a guy that's about 5'10". So it's suboptimally designed for someone of my size. I go and drive it, I crash it. Who's responsible for that? Difficult to really lay the blame in any one place. I'm a little bit thinking, you know what, buyer beware is a big part of this. I'm a little bit thinking that, of course, there should be some standards on the vendor side. But the transparency is probably the main thing. You know, you've got to just clearly state, hey, here's what we are saying we're going to do, here's what we're saying we definitely can't do.
You've got to be really, really sophisticated to make full use of something like that at scale. You've got to be really sophisticated, and that's not a decision a talent acquisition team can go and make.
No, we've got a gap there. I think what I'm getting mostly out of this conversation and dialogue is that TA is generally grossly under-equipped to make a vendor decision, under-equipped to make full utilization of it, and even monitor and track its effectiveness. I think that's on us. So, you know, we need to carry the argument back internally to the business and say, look, we need different types of people in our functions to be able to make these better decisions.
Let me suggest that you need a couple of kinds of people. Can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead, John.
So you need a couple of kinds of people. You need somebody who looks at the liability and ethical issues, and that's separate from the sort of workflow and implementation issues, right? And you need both kinds of people to effectively deploy this stuff. And so that's two headcount, right? This one of the things that you hear about this stuff is that it reduces expense, and that's rarely true. The actual infrastructure required to manage this stuff is more complex and more sophisticated than the infrastructure that we currently have.
Yeah, I would kind of mirror some of that. Actually, Lauren will talk, I think, on the CogX stage around our ethics, and we actually have AI principles that we have on our website that say these are the principles that drive the development and the use of our AI and we follow that through with our customers. But I agree, there is a gap. When we implement a solution with a customer, we always find a gap between the current TA knowledge set and how to use and draw upon this. And so we do try to make it as simple as possible, right? But there is usually a gap, and there is, in many cases, legal reviews as well, which is like any good assessment should have a good legal review. But I don't think that's as much of a gap as it is. People are thinking of these AI solutions as different than what we always have done with interviewing and selection and design systems. Nothing has changed, just the methodology behind the scenes has changed, and that's it.
I think a lot of these enhancements or potential enhancements to the way we do talent acquisition is a good thing for RPO businesses as they continue to become technology managers at a faster rate than in-house talent acquisition teams do.
Yep. I'm just to jump in on that, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it could well be that you'll get this is an opportunity for RPO, and not only to think about them as cost reducers, if you like, but people who have the expertise that can carry the expertise to be able to help companies implement this type of technology. Right now, I'm pretty certain right now it's beyond most internal TA teams.
Most, yeah.
One way of thinking about RPOs is that they've become technology providers, that they're not really RPOs particularly any longer, but they solve the problem of you know, I track new vendors in this space, and there are 700 of them. and it's beyond the capacity of a department's procurement group to make sense out of those 700 competing claim sets. RPOs can do that and then deliver an integrated product for you that keeps you at the state of the art. And so that's where their advantage will ultimately emerge, I think.
Yep, very interesting. Okay, guys, listen, I think we could keep on talking about this topic, but I realize that we're running like well over time. So I don't think I can keep you guys any longer on the call. I know that you've got stuff to do and a full day. So I do thank you, John. Thank you so much for stepping in and sharing your thoughts with us. I've shared John's articles, by the way, on HR Examiner. I'd recommend everyone to go ahead and read them, particularly if you are a buyer or thinking about buying technology products. There's some very interesting, almost the beginnings of a framework of decision-making that you might want to use when you're looking at product sets there. So thank you, John, for your contribution. I hope to get you back on the show at some other point. But you go ahead and have a great day, man.
All right. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks, everybody.
And Nathan, thank you so much for stepping in. I look forward to hearing more from the other team members you have at CogX. That's going to be an amazing event. You mentioned that Lauren was speaking about ethics. Is that right, Nathan?
Yeah, he's on a panel with that Megan was talking about with Frida and others.
Yep, amazing. Yeah, again, I recommend everyone check that out. I've actually got some discounted tickets for CogX, which I will share with the community in an email. People who are watching this, you're about to get an offer. I think you should take up on it to attend this event. That's happening in June, I think, or 10th, 11th, and 12th, three-day event next week. So Nathan, let me let you go. Thank you so much for your time. Again, I'd love to get you back on the show when we have a little bit more focus on time, particularly about the technology that HireVue are pushing. Yeah, I think it's a fascinating space that we need to know more about.
Great. Thanks for the time. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Take care, Nathan.
Bye.
So, I mean, I don't know about you, Adam. That's a fascinating show, right? I mean, I'll segue.
That's not the end of our discussion about AI.
I think we scratched the top of it, and then suddenly it just exploded. I'm not even dealing with half the things I saw on the chat there. I think there's a parallel conversation going on there, which I'd love to dive into as well. I think in future, as hosts, what we've got to do is be very narrow, actually. You know, we can't have an AI and recruitment topic anymore. We've got to say, okay, this is about bias in AI and recruitment.
AI in sourcing, AI in scheduling, AI in... I absolutely agree. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, I think essentially what we're saying is AI is now becoming ubiquitous. It'll start bleeding into all technology. So we're moving beyond the point where we can say, hey, here's what the impact on recruitment. We need to just put it down on a more granular level here. Yeah. All right. Well, that's about it. Everyone, thank you for your time. I appreciate you spending time with us in Brain Food Live on air. You got one thing to say, Adam? Go ahead.
I've got two very quick things to say. We did, and I'm afraid I got a little bit lost in it at one point. We have to do a show on the war for talent. The difference of opinion on this subject is really clear. And the second thing is, at 5'7", you should go and take a look at buying a Lotus, that car. I'm 5'11", and I tried to get in a Lotus one time. I just couldn't get in it. Built for you.
It's a mini car for mini home. No, but the point is, I mean, there's a gender thing there as well, right? We know cars are generally designed for like an adult male, 5'10", something like that. So, you know, we know that women have different types of injuries in car crashes, for instance. So all of this stuff needs to be thought about. But in any case, I just want to thank everyone for their time. I hope you've enjoyed the show. This will be out as a podcast as well. This will be available as a replay on here also. Quick reminder as well for everyone, we're going to be back next week. Adam, you're going to fly solo next week. So I'm handing over the reins whilst I'm in some country outside of the UK and probably not confident I can get online. But Adam's going to be taking on the show and talking about entry-level talent, I believe.
That's right. Christina Robinson's going to join me to host next week. And we're talking to a couple of experts around apprenticeships and graduate hiring.
Yep. Let me just quickly share the URL for that. We've got the great guys from White Hat joining us on there. So that's Ewan Blair and Sophie Edelman will be joining us for that. I highly recommend you sign up to the show. Okay, that's about it, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next week.
Bye-bye.